but may I ask you, this is such a an exceptional. Good morning. Welcome. How are you? Nice to see you, Molly. It's so great when you look around the room and you know almost everyone in it. It's really a terrific feeling. What do you think, Lens? Shall we?
Yeah.
Think we should go? Okay, we're 2 minutes after, as we know social entrepreneurs are notoriously late because they're always busy doing something really important, meeting other people and networking, which is part of why we're here at the Skoll Forum. So we're going to keep the doors open and hope that more join us. I'm Pat Mitchell, and I'm officially the moderator of this session, but we have had a regrettable and unexpected change in that Eve Ensler, who is the founder and leader of the V-Day movement, cannot be with us today. She asked me to extend her gratitude to each and every one of you for coming and to let you know that if there had been any way on earth for her to be here, she would. So in her place, rather than cancel the session, and I want to express my gratitude to the Skoll Forum for not doing that, we decided there is still a way to talk about this wild, fierce, unstoppable movement, which is the way the Skoll Forum describes it in the program, by my sharing my perspective as a speaker as well as a moderator, because I have been the chair of the V-Day board since its inception. So I can speak from that perspective. And then these two extraordinary V-Day activists who have joined us, Agnes Pareo from Kenya and Corinne Heisick from Berlin. And we will hear also from each of them, and they can then add to the story of the V-Day movement. So what I would like to do is give you a bit of a background. How many of you are familiar at all with V-Day? I thought perhaps there were many who are. So for some of you, this will be redundant, but if you'll allow me to give the background for those who don't know about it and lay the groundwork for why we saw this and the Skoll Forum saw this as an opportunity to look at this particular unique model for fundraising and for local grassroots empowerment and the way in which this movement has found ways to catalyze collaboration. So it all began with this charismatic playwright, actor, and activist named Eve Ensler, who in the early 90s wrote a book, a groundbreaking book called The Vagina Monologues. It ended up in a play on Broadway, which became a best-selling book and a very successful run on Broadway. Not only did it challenge people's notions of using a word they weren't accustomed to using, but it also, through the monologues, had women talking in very open, intimate ways, not only about their sex lives from often funny and poignant points of view, but also about the many ways in which they had been violated and had experienced violence in their lives. So the Vagina Monologues opened up a dialogue, if you will, not only among women, but between women and men about violence in a way that was truly astounding, even to Eve. And as it began to make money, and Eve began to put aside money from the many performances, we are now, by the way, this is just looking at where we are today, 12 years later, 10,000 events, meaning 10,000 performances of the Vagina Monologues all over the world this year, raised $70 million for over 10,000 groups who are working locally, and I'll explain how that model works, donated $2 million to the Spotlight campaigns, which I'll talk a bit more in a moment, and exposed $300 million to the V-Day message, which is that we must find ways in every community and country to end violence against women and girls. So the Vagina Monologues, which had become this big hit on Broadway, Eve began to get requests from all over the world. Can I perform it? Can I use it in my book club? Can I use it as a fundraiser? And so V-Day was born out of grassroots organizations fighting violence in remote places in Africa, as well as cities and college campuses in America, saying, let us perform the play. It'll be a way for us to start a new level of dialogue in our communities. So V-Day was established primarily to allow this, all groups, any groups anywhere in the world who wanted to perform the play and raise money through the performances of the play. V-Day as a national organization at that time was two people, Eve and an executive director. It's now expanded to 12 people, but there is still no office. It is completely, entirely a virtual organization that operates from wherever those 12 people may be, because it was not set up to become another NGO organization. It was set that would fund. It was set up to become a empowerment tool that comes with a full toolkit to any group that wants to perform either the Vagina Monologues, which has now been added by two additional books that Eve has written that have also become performance pieces. One is called A Rant, A Monologue and a Prayer, The Recollections of Men, Boys, Women, and Girls All Over the World. And the newest book to hit the bestseller list just last week, I Am an Emotional Creature, which are monologues of girls all over the world. So these three dramatic works are now available to any groups who are working to end violence in their communities or their countries. And through the vday.org website and the small national organization, we work with these groups, we vet them to make sure that they are doing legitimate, important work on the ground, and then they're given the rights to perform the play. All proceeds from any performance of any V-Day material stays with the local community. That's why you see out of the $70 million that was raised, only $2 million of it was kept by the national organization, and that was kept to fund the spotlight campaigns, which we'll talk about in a moment. As you see, celebrities have come to the movement because it is a dramatic piece, and that, of course, has helped to raise the money. And we'll move on through these. These are just some of the examples of where the play has been performed and how the play has been performed. This last year, in February alone, there were 5,000 colleges and universities performing the play, raising money at that level for the local groups. And just an anecdote about how getting involved at the high school and college level with the V-Day and becoming one of the people who either performs or is a part of producing it has begun to change lives in ways that we are measuring and tracking, because we keep a list of these organizations and we stay in close touch with them, all of the 10,000 groups that have performed the play at one time or the other. And we have now begun to see that girls who at 14 and 15 and 16 were a part of bringing the Vagina Monologues to their high school to raise money for the anti-violence group that they were a part of in their high school are now becoming community leaders. In fact, one who did her first Vagina Monologues as a producer at age 14 just got elected to the U.S. Congress from California. So we do know that there is an empowerment model that that comes with opening the dialogue. And these, again, are just pictures so that you can see the breadth and the depth and the scope of where these performances have taken place. The play's been translated into 70-something languages. Each group finds its own interpretation of how to advertise and to bring people in to see the play. It's been interesting also to see the ways in which vagina gets translated into all kinds of languages. This was in Rome, a gathering of the V-Day activists, and I think that was, 2002? And so once a year, we offer the opportunity for the activists who have been a part of performing the plays or raising money in their communities through any of the V-Day toolkits to come together, and we spend a day in training sessions often and sharing stories and perspectives with each other. 2 years ago, we went to the Middle East for the first time, and the play was performed in many countries in the Middle East. Actually, just this last February was performed in Pakistan, There were bomb threats, and we were asked to evacuate the theater several times, but not one single person left the theater. They stayed to the end, and that group of very courageous men and women in Pakistan who are fighting violence in that community benefited greatly from the performance. Not, I think, just to feel the sense of community support that was there that night. And as you can see from the photos that we hope bring a bit of Eve into the room with us this morning, but also indicating how many of these performances go on. And in Mexico and in other places around the world, Eve decided that along with the empowering of local groups, that the national organization could do a bit more when the situation called for it. So in Mexico, you may remember, there were these horrendous murders of young women working in the American factories. So V-Day organized a march, which brought together 5,000 of V-Day activists from all over the world and marched in support of the Mexican women. This led to an investigation and to the first appointment of a defense counsel who took on and finally won. Two or three people were brought to justice, but not nearly enough. In Haiti, 10 years ago, V-Day targeted again a spotlight campaign for that country, and Eve spent a lot of time there realizing that there was no organized anti-violence movement for women there. So when we find these situations where the grassroots activists on the ground have not been sufficiently empowered or organized to really take the toolkit and raise their own money, then we spend a year or so strengthening the organization so that when we leave later, there will be a well-funded infrastructure that can continue to do the work. And in Haiti, that work ended up in the creation of a V-Day safe house, which again, identifying the right women and men on the ground to work there, to be empowered by V-Day. They ran the safe house very successfully and very effectively. Sadly, the V-Day's safe house was destroyed in the earthquake, and all four of the V-Day activists were killed in the earthquake. So we will go back to Haiti. We are already back there as an organization, taking some safe tents for immediate response to the huge number of women and girls who are being exposed, as you heard Dr. Farmer talk about last night, by sleeping on the streets and in the darkness. The level of violence is escalating enormously, so these tents have been specially designed that have locks on them so that they can go in, and they're being put aside by this small group of activists who have continued to work there. You may have already seen, I think we might go a little faster through the photos, that in Afghanistan, even before the fall of the Taliban, we got a call asking for support for a small group of underground activists. Sakina, welcome. It's wonderful to see you. Who were running schools for girls. And no one could talk about that better than the person, Sakina, who is with us this morning. So again, V-Day sent funds, and mobile phones were put in the hands of these women so they might create a communications network. So what we try to do is, all of you know so well who run your own organizations, be they community-based, regional, or countrywide, it's so important to always ask the people on the ground, what is it you need? So often we go in with money without asking that very key question. How would you like to see the funds used, or what could we do to help you most? And I think that's the one thing that V-Day and Eve said from the beginning. We'll not go in with answers or solutions. We'll go in finding the people who are already doing the work and find a way to further empower them. So we are currently moving the Spotlight campaign to the 2010 campaign, started in 2008. Focusing on Congo. You might have seen briefly rushing through there as we're doing, so we have plenty of time for your questions. The New Orleans campaign was our 10th year campaign, and 18,000 B-Day activists, men and women from all over the world, came together to reclaim New Orleans and the Superdome and to turn that into a place of healing. And what happened there inspired us to think about this model of collaborating with other NGOs in areas of great and desperate need to create places of healing, places of restoration, places of retraining. And there seemed to be no place on the face of the earth more in need of it than the Democratic Republic of Congo. There are nearly 500,000 women and girls being raped and brutally assaulted there for the last 18 years as part of a lawless militia and a civil war that no one seems to understand or know how to stop. And in the Congo, the women had absolutely no way of organizing among themselves to start to fight back in some reasonable and sensible way. Eve spent a lot of time there. Again, I found the Congolese women already doing the work, but without proper funds and certainly without any kind of support from the government or even from the community. So V-Day set up an office, small office in Bakavu, which is where most of the violence takes place in that area, hired a Congolese woman, and she began to go around village to village with small amounts of funds and, more importantly, with the organizational support, saying, let's start to bring women together and to talk about what we have to do as a group and as a community to stop this violence. Meanwhile, the violence continued to escalate, and there is one hospital that treats as many women as it can. One brave, courageous doctor you may have heard of, Dr. Dennis Mwege, does 300 surgeries a week, putting women's lives and bodies back together. And then they go back, where they cannot return to their homes and families usually, and often end up as a victim again in the hospital. So when we ask again the Congolese activists, what can we do that would change this situation most profoundly for you? They said, build us a refuge center. Build us a place where we can go and get our lives back on track. Give us a place to heal, a place to rest, a place to refuge. And what came out of that was the City of Joy. This is the announcement of it. They named it. It's 100 acres of land in this very rural area where the Panzi Hospital is. So women now will go, this is Eve with the Congolese women, who not only raised many of the funds there, but we raised $5 million in 18 months in the United States to build and totally sustain the operations of the City of Joy for the next 5 years. 60% of the workers carrying concrete blocks on their heads are women. That was part of the contract with the architect, that he had to hire Congolese women who had never done architectural work before, but as Bunker knows, they're very trainable, right? And they loved it. They pretty soon were making sure that they were in charge of all of the building crews, which they became. So this is some of the women who helped build this place. It's almost finished. It opens next month. 100 women will move in, and they'll get 9 months there, where they will get all kinds of healing therapies, which are necessary given what they have gone through physically. They'll get retraining. Google Foundation is building a tech center for tech training. A biodynamic farming organization is coming in, and you may have seen their beautiful fields surrounding the City of Joy, and so they'll grow their own food. Vital Voices has established a radio station, which one of the Congolese women has been trained to run. So with UNICEF as a partner, with all the other NGOs who are on the ground in Congo, this money is being shared to make sure that it's a completely sustainable operation, at least for the first 5 years. And then, of course, through the collaboration that has been built with all the NGOs. This is the picture of it. V-Day will continue to be the lead organization in the fundraising, but it will be, as is every other campaign that V-Day has been a part of, a collaborative effort with whatever groups are on the ground and whatever other national and global NGOs might want to choose to step forward and be a partner. So that's a very brief overview and story of the first 12 years of a movement that Eve had the audacity to say 12 years ago. This is not a movement about fixing violence, building safe houses, shelters. This is a movement about ending violence. And as we know, the causes are systemic, difficult, complex, and from culture to culture, raise all kinds of challenges for us. We still believe that's the mission. In the meantime, we are doing whatever else is necessary with the groups who are there saying to us, we need a shelter. We need a place to heal. We need money to do this. We need you to get this NGO group to talk to this president. Looking for the opportunities to be a collaborative partner to catalyze what this whole forum is about this week, bringing us all together. So I want to stop here, give you a chance to ask questions about V-Day in general, and then I very specifically want Agnes to share her story, because it's a story of, on a very individual basis, how one movement began, was empowered and funded with this collaborative model, and is now making a huge amount of difference in the Maasai Mara. So may I ask you or invite you now for any questions that you might have of me on the more general story of V-Day as a movement? Yes?
I'm very impressed by everything I hear. My name is Ingrid Strandum.
Yes, please. May I ask you to say your name?
We have been working for the last 1.5 years with the group that actually set up the department in the Pansy Hospital for helping women from the fistula operations, right, where Dr. Mukwege is working. And what we did was, last year we sent down a journalist and a photographer who are both very well known in the Congo area, and they made a report about some of the work that's being done there. And a beautiful book with fantastic pictures. We had our foreign minister write the forewords. The book has been translated into English. What we did, we invited all the Norwegian organizations active in Congo. And it's actually one woman who started this Pansy Hospital. She was down there and saw how bad things were. So she just went to the Norwegian and British government and had funding. And now they're building a new hospital with help from the U.S. This book is sort of, in a way, a coffee table book. It's a good story because it tells how two Congolese women go out in the bushes, find women that have been hurt, bring them to the hospital and have them operated. But of course, the challenge is then what?
Yes, right.
This book is something that I wish to, if you want to use it, what we are saying is that if you want to sell this book, you can do it. The only prerequisite is that the money goes to the women in Congo.
Fabulous.
So I'm sorry I didn't bring it. I have it in the hotel. But this is a very good story about how we made all the organizations in Norway cooperate to sell the book and to help the women down there. And it's
please give me a copy. And I'll
you can have the PDF and you can print it to the extent you want. It's made great. Our prime minister gave our foreign minister gave this book to Hillary Clinton, and she was so impressed that she has been saying that she wants to help. Maybe that's in your organization also.
Yeah, Secretary Clinton made a very historic statement in Congo. She said, this will be the place where violence against women and girls is no longer tolerated as an act of war. It's still being tolerated. There's still not been one single militia brought to trial or justice, and the rapes go on every day. But because of many dedicated governments and groups, there is more activity on the ground than there has ever been. And by the way, the model of books and the model of plays has proven to other groups to be very successful. I don't want to indicate in any way that V-Day has a unique lock on this as a concept. There are many NGOs who have often recognized art as the activist tool that it is. It's just that this particular play took off in a certain way and had a certain resonance and way for women and men, I think, to open up the conversation, that it's been hugely successful as a fundraising tool. But there are many other groups that have also used books and all other kinds of art as a way to start a conversation, raise awareness, and in fact raise money. Yes, sir. And may I ask you to make the questions rather short so we'll be sure to get the other stories in too.
Yeah. My name is Dan Karzlik. I'm an American filmmaker. The V-Day movement is an incredible example of really everything we're talking about. Did I hear you say that you don't have a standing office?
That's true.
And if
never
that's true,
had.
How have you been able to accomplish these huge events, these meetings of 18,000 activists here and 5,000? That's incredible. I think we'd all love to hear how that happened.
Well, I think you might see the three of us kind of moan when you say that, because Eve is a visionary, and when she said she was doing New Orleans and was literally going to bring 18,000 people to New Orleans, a city that had no infrastructure at the time anyway, and reclaim the Superdome, we all went, please, could we think of something just a little bit smaller? But she never thinks small, and it was literally done with, at that time, a staff of 8, I think. There has never been an office. There is, everybody works virtually. In fact, none of the 12 live in the same city, except for Eve and her assistant. But that's it. Everybody else lives in different parts of the country and the world. It's just the way women and enlightened men do things. What can I tell you? We just don't just say, yes, we will do this. And one of the great things in the New Orleans story was the women who came together in New Orleans didn't even know each other. And through the earthquake hurricane had become increasingly separated from each other. So it brought them all back together, and they became a powerful force and brought back all of the women from the diaspora who had left after the violence. They brought 2,000 of them back in buses. So we thought, how are you going to organize that? How are you going to find them? But they did. They found them, and they brought them all back for the weekend of celebration and resettled them. There was a film made that called Until the Violence Stops, a documentary that Lifetime aired 2 or 3 years ago, I think. And there is a film being made about the City of Joy opening. So thank you for the nice words. One or two more questions, then I want to move to Agnes. Annie.
I just wondered if you might... Oh, sorry, everyone. I'm
Annie. Would you take the mic, Annie, so we can hear you? Thank you.
My voice carried by itself.
Well, it does from stage beautifully.
I'm Annie Lennox. I'm a singer-songwriter and activist mainly for HIV and AIDS. What I would like to hear from you is a little bit about the perpetrators of the violence. I think that would be very interesting. That's the question, really. Would you just like to talk a little bit about that?
In Congo specifically, everywhere?
Not necessarily. I'm really curious about the psychology behind the need to express this very, whether it's an act of rage, whether it's an act of empowerment in some kind of bizarre, twisted way. Mm-hmm. I really want to understand why women are raped and what is the thinking behind the perpetrator.
Boy, if I had the answer to that, I think we could just all go home and feel a lot safer this evening. I heard Dr. Mukwege ask this question many times as we toured the U.S. Raising money for PANSY, because the brutality of the rapes in Congo are unlike any that we've reported in our modern times. You honestly cannot listen to them, and I couldn't repeat them without breaking down. But he repeats them over and over again because he wants people to understand that it is an act of war, that the war is being fought on women's bodies, just as it was fought in Bosnia and many other places around the world. And so it is the rage of anger, hate, whatever it is against the enemy, however that is defined, and women and girls are the vulnerable, easy to attack, humiliate, destroy. That's the way I've heard him describe it. And it's certainly the way you heard Bosnian rape victims describe what happened there, too. And it has always been an act of war. I mean, throughout history. But it is particularly brutal, it seems.
But as it plays out in townships, in communities, within communities that are in some way screwed up hugely, is that an act of war? That's not an act of war.
No. I wish I could. Does anybody, any sociologist, psychologist, anybody who's done work in this area, there are many explanations, but the one thing we know, it has nothing to do with sex.
Yeah.
Has everything to do with...
Would you agree that it's an expression of some kind of dysfunction?
Yes, of course. I mean, absolutely. Clearly, it is. And if it can happen anyway, this is why it has to end, and it can't just be fixed or only happens to this group of people. As long as it is allowed, as long as it goes on with impunity, anywhere in the world, women and girls are vulnerable victims. And it is seen to be allowed that you can act out your rage, your anger, your need to pillage and murder for revenge or whatever else the motivation is at the time. If it's allowed because there are no means by which people are brought to justice and someone says, you cannot do this, it will go on. And to go on it the way it is going on in Congo, literally condoned by the rest of the world, because we are not stopping it. And we could.
Do you want to talk a little about B-men?
Yes. Why don't you?
Okay.
I haven't introduced Corinne Heisek yet, and we're going to tell her story in a moment, how she came to V-Day, but why don't you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just wanted also, in response to what Annie brought up, we've been working as a, not an exclusive women's movement, but as a movement that mainly engaged women through the act of performing on stage, and most of the activists were women. It seemed like over the years that it was mainly women who were interested in ending violence against women. That's how it went so far, and of course always along with a few enlightened men. But we also noticed through the time that if, of course, we can prevent and end violence by empowering women and making them stronger and by changing mentalities, but it's at least as important to change the mentalities of the perpetrators. So we need to work with the men and look at, you know, what can we do? How can we bring up boys to, you know, how can we work with them on their kind of attitudes? What makes them want to hurt a woman, you know? So what V-Day has started doing now is to look at ways to engage men more actively, and there have been more and more men who wanted to get engaged in the movement. And so we have the piece that you mentioned earlier, A Memory, a Monologue, a Rant, and a Prayer, which has also pieces for men that they can perform. But now we are looking at engaging men in the future even more actively. And we are, well, Eve and a friend of hers, a playwright, Mark Matusek, they're working on developing a script, which will be called, well, this is like the working title, 10 Ways to Be a Man, which will be looking at, you know, what does it mean to be a man? Where does this aspect of being violent, especially against women and girls, where does it come from? What does it mean within the context of masculinity around the world? And so we started this process through a series of workshops. So this year, V-Day activists had the opportunity, male V-Day activists had the opportunity to participate in workshops that discuss all these issues, to get together as a group of exclusively of men, to talk among themselves, to discuss all these issues. And so we are learning from what is coming out of these workshops, and we are working on an artistic piece to come out of that, to even more actively engage men into the movement.
In fact, we can't end violence against women and girls clearly without bringing the perpetrators as well as all the other men who want to end for the perpetrators the violence. And so the V-Day men's movement has just begun, and we look forward to having a lot more to report on that. But I want to bring Agnes, if we just might skip to the end of your story, and then I'll go back and do it from the beginning, not exactly the right way. But I was in Kenya, a graduation ceremony at Agnes's school this summer, and a man spoke, a father, And it just so was so clear to us that ending FGM, ending other kinds of cultural violence, absolutely depends on changing the attitudes there with men as well as with men and girls. Tell the story of the father at the graduation when he was reconciled with his daughter.
When we reconciled this daughter with the father, the girl had run to us because she didn't want to be mutilated. And since we run a temporary safe house where girls run to, and then at a certain point, after monitoring and talking to the father, we take the girl officially to the parent. And then when we took the girl to the parent, she was asked by my friends, why did you want to mutilate this girl? He said, well, all my cows have died because of the prolonged drought, and I had nowhere else to go to except to mutilate this girl, marry her off so that I can earn a dowry. So that was the reason why this girl was being mutilated, so that she was going to be eligible for marriage, for the parents to get cows back.
And he said at the graduation, he said, so now I look at my daughter and she's educated. She spent 4 years at this girls' center. She's worth a lot more than those three cows now.
Yeah.
And we all said, you see, you make the economic argument and you're done. So Agnes, let's go back. When Eve first met Agnes many years ago, Agnes was walking barefoot, the Rift Valley, carrying an anatomy of a woman, a torso, and was carrying it literally village to village, sitting down with the elders in the village and explaining why female genital mutilation should be ended. And you met Eve, and you pick up the story there.
Yeah, I met Eve in 1999, if I can remember, and I was in a classroom teaching about 50 school primary teachers. And when Eve came, I was busy showing my model. The model shows the different types of female genital mutilation. And why I use a model is because the people I talk to are people that have never gone to school. And you know, for somebody who have not gone to school, when she sees something, she cannot forget. But when you just go talk, she will not remember what you said. So I preferred showing the model where I can show the types, the effects of female genital mutilation. And by so doing, as they sit and they walk, they can also be discussing what they saw. And then after my lesson, Eve said to me, Agnes, what can we do to help you? Then I said, Eve, I walk from village to village. Like now I'm here, you found me. There are no vehicles because it is in the interior part of Narok where there are no roads. I walk to that place. And if I can get a vehicle that can make my work easy, then I can appreciate. Then he said, here you are, you'll have it. And then after she came back, after 2 weeks, I got the vehicle, and it made my work easy. So I reached more people than I used to when I was alone and when I was walking, because the roads were bad and the wild animals were there, and at times I was at risk of the wild animals, but still I had to do it because I was committed to educating my community. And then after 1 year, Eve came again and said, Agnes, what can I do for you? And because I had done my work for 1 year, girls had started now running to me, and I didn't have a place to keep these girls because I didn't have enough food. I couldn't, there was nothing that I could do to these girls. Then I said, Eve, if we can have a small place, I didn't think of a big place, just a small place where these girls can run to, that can be their temporary home, before I reconcile them or before I solve their problems, then we can be more than happy. Then she said, how much do you need? I said, well, I don't know, but I have to look for somebody, a contractor, who can do that. And then after doing all the work, we got the money. Now, in the year 2000, Eve came to Kenya, and we officially opened the first safe house in the year 2000. And this is a small, not really small, but it can accommodate 48 girls at a time. And this is just a temporary place where these girls run to, and then I do the reconciliation. They go back to their families, and my role shall be to monitor these girls to make sure that they are in school. Because after rescuing these girls, I take them to school. Because I feel and think that it is important for these girls to have education. Because education is power. And all what we are talking about here, and what we think, and what we want to change, nothing will ever change before women have gone to school and understood their roles and be aware of what is needed. Because what they lack is empowerment. Otherwise, once we empower women, then we shall have empowered the whole community. So after the girls come into us, we take them to school. And then I went back to Eve. Eve, now these girls are running to me, and I want to take them to school because I don't want to take them back the way they were. I want to take them to primary boarding schools, government schools, because I also don't want to isolate them. I want them to be part of the community, and this is by taking them to the schools where the other kids go. Then Eve said, no, I have no problem. We'll pay their school fees. We'll take care of these girls, and until their parents accept these girls. So every girl that we got, she had to go to school. And it was up to V-Day to pay school fees for the girls. And then by now, as we talk, we have a second safe house. Because the model worked in my community, the Maasai community. And as we talk now, there is a very high demand of the other neighboring Maasai districts, that is in Transmara, Kajiado, where they also want a safe house where these girls can run to. This is because FGM is a culture that is deeply rooted among our people. Our people value it. And the only way to end FGM is to educate the community to understand the effects of female genital mutilation. And we bring in everybody on board. We bring the fathers, because in an African setup, the father is the lawmaker of the family. So we also bring them in. We bring youth boys so that these boys can accept these girls and marry these girls even without going through female genital mutilation. Because when we ask why female genital mutilation is performed, everybody you talk to says it is a stage to adulthood for the girls to be accepted for marriage. And when you look at it, we also rescue girls who run away from early childhood marriages. This is because our girls are married off as from the ages of 11, 12, 13. You see a very old man marrying a young girl of 12 just to be his second wife or his third or fourth wife, because our people are polygamists. We saw that these two cultures are cousins or sisters. If we don't address them, then we shall not be doing anything. So at the center, we either have a girl running away from early marriage or from female genital mutilation. And now, as we talk, we are now running two centers, one in Sakutiek and one that is based in Narok. And one that is in Narok already for this holiday, we have, other than having the 48 girls, we have 68 girls. And in the other one, we have 50 girls. So in total, we have 118 girls that V-Day is paying school fees for, taking care of them. This is where they call their temporary home. This is where they call their temporary home. And as we reconcile them, other new girls come in. And we are lucky to have a Children's Act in place, 2001. We also use the law, where we find that the parents want to force these girls to be circumcised or these girls to be married off. We take them to court. Like last week, we had a case of a girl who was mutilated, and because as a result of bleeding, this girl died. We pushed for the case. We had even to call Equality Now. I don't know whether you know of Equality Now. They helped us to engage a lawyer, and the circumciser and the father, because the mother was crying, because the father just brought a woman who didn't even know how to cut. And then as a result of the careless cutting, the girl died. So the woman was also crying when we went to the family, because we have informers. As our program, we train our informers on the ground who inform us of what is going on. We bring them in for a 3 days awareness meeting on what FGM is, and then we give them our numbers, and a small amount of money. When they want to call us, they can call us, tell us what is going on, because we cannot be everywhere. So when I was informed, Agnes, can you come and save this girl? This girl is bleeding. So by the time I went there, the girl had already died. And then to make the whole thing worse, they buried the girl immediately. So when I went with the police, and then we came to court. The magistrate ordered for the body to be exhumed. And then when it was exhumed, the doctor ascertained that the death was caused by bleeding as a result of the cut. And now, last week, the judgment was made, and they were jailed for 10 years, which was, I don't say it was good for our culture, but we are using it as an educational tool to show them that it is wrong and to show them that the law protects girls and women. Because if we will not do that, they will remain where they are, and we shall not be making a difference in what we are doing. We tell them, as much as you love their culture, traditions change.
Yes. And I wanted to point to something that you said and give the audience a chance to ask you more questions about your work, Agnes. She mentioned Equality Now, and again, it's part of the model that we always try and encourage. And at Tesoura, while Vida pays keys, school fees and operates, we bring in every other group that can be of help. And Equality Now has been of enormous help in helping to pursue the legal ways to end this practice. So let's take a few questions for Agnes now, if we might. Yes. And just again, please state your name, organization, if you wish, and briefly the question.
My name is Allison Hewitt, and I run a social innovation program in Toronto, Canada. I'm really interested in asset-based approach. You are an asset. How do we get more you?
That is such a good question. If we could duplicate Agnes, violence would have ended already, certainly.
I don't know how to answer that, because I believe when you start something out of a feeling that you have on that thing. And when I was young, I was among the few that went to school. Even if I didn't go far, but I just went to school and I got enlightened and knew what I wanted to do. And then when I was in school, I had a friend who kept telling me, Agnes, why do these girls come when their heads are shaved? Because normally when you go through FGM, you are shaved. Then I tell her, well, something they are cut. Then it ends there. Then she said, promise me that when you go home, you'll not be cut. I said, well, I'll not be cut. So when I went home, I said, I'll not be cut. And then my mom was not happy with it. My dad said, well, let us stay. Because not all the communities in Kenya that practice FGM. It's just a few communities that practice FGM. Then my mother and my grandmother insisted that it should happen to me. So it was done on me forcefully. And that's why I was attentive to the pain. I felt great pain. I bleeded the whole day. I underwent for 2 weeks. I didn't know where I was. So I grew up hating it. So when I grew up, I thought I should fight this. And Maasai girls should go to school rather than being married off. That's where I started. I didn't know that I was going to arrive to rescuing them. Because when you start walking, at times you walk not even knowing towards the direction you go. So every year you find you are not going the same direction you wanted, it has turned you to another direction. Then you keep going until you get what you want. So I don't know how, but I believe they are there.
I think the answer is finding them on the, because they are there in every country as we know.
And again, one thing about VIDE, they look for grassroots women. When they came to Nairobi, that is the headquarters of Kenya, they said to Maendeleo Wanawake, a women organization, whom do you know that is doing something to end violence? Then they said, we know of a woman in Narok. She's always on the papers. She's doing something. That's when I was called. So when you go, and especially when you are changing a culture, make sure that you are using the right person, the person who comes from that community, who understands the culture and who can talk to the people and whom people believe and trust. This is one of us. There could be something that she's talking about. So The good thing about VIDE is that they don't go ahead of you. They are there, they ask you what you want to do, then they move with you as you walk.
We have several questions, so we'll start here and then we'll go this way.
Is it on? Yeah. I'm Deborah Holmes, and I'm with Ernst & Young, but that's not relevant here. What I'm wondering about is tourism is so important to Kenya, and in particular going to see the Maasai is so important for tourists who come to Kenya. What are the ways that tourists can share their voice? Because FGM is so shocking in parts of the world, in most of the world, thank goodness, that doesn't practice it. What are the ways that tourists can use the tourist voice and the tourist dollar to speak out against it?
Well, the Maasais are just a very small community in Kenya that cannot even make a difference. The representation in the government is very small. Their voices are not heard. That is why it's not anything in the government. They don't even mention it because this is something that has to, it's not a priority in the government. And you see, our tourism, our parks are enjoyed by the government. And of course, we live there with the wild animals, but we don't benefit from the wild animals. So it's not a priority in the government. That's why it has to be the NGOs pushing, trying to assist these small communities to stop some of these harmful traditional practices that has effects on the bodies of women. So I don't know how it can happen, but that is the fact that the government is not a priority of the government to stop FGM in the communities. We are lucky they have the Children's Act that speaks about FGM from year 1 to 18 years. If it happens on you when you are 19, fine. You have no law that can protect you.
But it can make you a very unpopular person in a safari camp to bring it up and talk about it. But that's one way to do it, by the way. Yes. There and there were two hands that we're trying to get
Sit
to
on.
Quickly.
Yeah, can you hear me? Yeah. Thank you for your very moving and courageous story. It was very touching. I just wanted to ask a question about what happens to the girls a few years on after being at your safe house in terms of reintegrating them into their own communities. What's their path after the education that's provided them, et cetera?
Just as I said, if we educate women, we shall have moved a step forward. These girls come from the safe house empowered, knowing their rights. When they go back to their communities, they know what they want. And our role shall be to monitor these girls to make sure that they are still in school. Some of them are now teachers. This is somebody who knows what she wants. And some of them, we have one who is now in the medical school. She went through our safe house. So these girls, they just need education and awareness to make them say no to what they don't want. And because we also train boys, the fathers, we don't leave them. We move the whole community, because if we leave somebody behind, he will be pushing the girls and telling them no. So we bring everybody on board.
So they're accepted back into the community.
Yes, yes, they witness.
The reconciliation effort starts the minute they arrive, so that communication is kept open with the family, although the girls aren't returned against their will. So it's a tricky negotiation that goes on, but they many, many more are reconciled now than were 5 years ago, wouldn't you say, Agnes?
Yeah.
Yes. Another question?
Hi, Agnes, my name is Mona Altahawi. I'm from Egypt. I'm a writer and public speaker, but I live in New York now. And I just want to tell you that I love you. I truly do, because I am the first generation in my family to not have been subject to FGM. 95% of women in Egypt are subject to FGM, various forms of it. And people are shocked when they hear these rates, because people always imagine, you know, it's this, well, I'm not even going to talk about what people imagine, because there's awful stereotypes out there. But it was only just about a month and a half ago that I wrote a column saying that I'm the first generation, because it was always something so shocking and shameful to me that it had happened to my mother and my aunts. Mm-hmm. And my mother is herself now a physician with a PhD. So this cuts across all communities, because when people talk about Egypt, especially, they'll say, you know, oh, it's just the poor, it's just those in the rural areas, and it's just simply not true. It's so prevalent in the culture, it cuts across all educational and all income backgrounds. And I think the biggest obstacle to actually to breaking through and trying to change things is just talking about it. So I, you know, in telling you how much I appreciate what you do, it's so important what V-Day does in staging things like the vagina monologues, because in Egypt, when a group of young women at the American University in Cairo staged the vagina monologues, they had to do it secretly, and they had police and security outside because we can't talk about vaginas. And unless we talk about vaginas and sex and women's sexuality, because the big elephant in the room here is about sex. They're cutting women's genitals because they don't want women to enjoy sex. Mm-hmm. This is what it's about at the end of the day, and it doesn't matter what religion you are, Muslim, Christian, non-religion, atheist, it's just controlling women's bodies. So I don't have a question for you. I just want to share my love for you because what you do is wonderful.
Thank you for that. There's here, and I apologize. Was there a hand over here that I didn't see when I was looking at Agnes? Okay, well, I just want to make sure you know I'm watching. And there's, yes, in the back, quickly.
Again, not so much a question as a comment. I'm from Kenya, and one of the things that has struck me, I'm from Kenya, I wear many hats. I study the Democratic Republic of the Congo as part of my studies in conflict studies and conflict transformation. And one of the things that strikes me is something that's come up in the subtext here, which is there's many different faces to many different places. I'm privileged in many ways in that I grew up in Nairobi in a community that doesn't practice FGM. But one of the things that you said that really struck me was about educating women and empowering women. Because I work with a small school in Kibera that works with girls who are unable to get education, who've been orphaned by HIV/AIDS. And they take them in, and some of them are being raped by their fathers, by their brothers, by, you know, close relatives, family. And it strikes me that I would love to help, but we are faced by so many of these problems and so many different faces of the same thing, which is ultimately how do we keep this 51% of the world's population down? And I would just love to say to... Sorry. I think that it's really important that stories like yours get told, not just to people in New York, in London, in Oxford, or whatever, but to people in Nairobi and people who are trying... however little ways that they can, need to know that what they think and what they feel and they can help and what they do matters.
Thank you. You know, you are one of those assets that this young vet was asked about. There are always ways you can help. And in that performance, you know, it made such a big difference, and even though it had to be done in secret and in private, that what's empowering is knowing women are claiming that ability all over the world throughout. I want to move to Karen's story, but I want to take two more. This young one, yes, in the back.
Thank you very much. I like the idea that you have safe houses for these girls and you really take them through the school system as well. They get educated. I was thinking that, I don't know, if there's a possibility for you, maybe that after these girls are through the school system, they also come together and help you to do this. Because I feel these girls can be very powerful and they can be able to really change their own communities. As you were saying that the Maasai community is, they are very small communities in your country and they are not heard at national level. Yeah. But you know what? These girls will be heard in their own communities because mm-hmm. they are from there. Mm-hmm. As small as they are, they can be very powerful mm-hmm. and they can help you to do the job.
Well, thank you. Agnes, you want to respond?
I agree with you because at the moment we have two of our girls who have gone to a teacher's training college. These girls come over the holidays and do tuition with the other girls. And then we have the one that has done tailoring. We hire her again. She comes and makes clothes for the other girls. So we make use of these girls after they have gone out.
Okay, I don't know which hand was up first. Here, I didn't get this side yet. So this gentleman there, or whoever has...
Hi, my name is Abbas Jaffer. I'm an associate editor at a website called altmuslima.com. Last year, I had the fortune of getting to know a young man, my peer, basically, from Nairobi, who talked to me about a project he's working on with alternative rites of passage. And a question I had for Agnes in terms of a social innovation, really innovating on getting to the root reasons that underlie the commission of FGM is this sort of passage into adulthood, as you said. Yeah. And I'm curious about your thoughts and your optimism and what you're seeing in terms of the potential for alternative rites of passage to make that happen.
I think it was just an oversight because I started the alternative rites of passage in Kenya. And as you were saying, they came to attend one of our alternative rites of passage. And everybody is now duplicating that and trying to do it in a small place. Why we started the alternative rites of passage? We looked at the process of the cutting and the whole ceremony. We saw that all what they were doing was good, except the cutting. The teachings of the mother, because that is when the mother could start talking to a girl, making the girl understand her body, how she needs to relate to boys. That is like sexual education. So we thought we will need it where we bring girls to a 5-day seclusion, and then we talk to them, showing them that it's, the cutting is not important, and it cannot change you to be a grown-up. If you are 13 and 14, you have to be 18 to call yourself a grown-up. So by the end of it, we celebrate, we dance, we give them presents, and we invite the parents because we do the alternative rites of passage with the knowledge of the parents. And how we gauge our work is by the numbers we get for the alternative rites of passage. Because at times we organize, we have 50 girls, and then the parents end up bringing another 50. That makes a number to be 100. Then it shows that the module have been accepted by the community. So we have the reconciliation. We rescue these girls. We reconcile them. We have also introduced the alternate rites of passage. We have also we also bring on board the circumcisers. Tell them, no, we are not saying you are doing the wrong thing. You can please stop this. You can earn a living out of doing something else. And when we have funds, we have two groups we have put together of circumcisers, and we buy a grinding, a portion mill grinding machine. We tell them this is now a business. You can earn from it, other than earn from cutting our daughters. So we have so many activities, not only one activity. We have so many activities because we have to look to all the ways to bring everybody on board so that we don't leave anybody.
It's such an important part of the story that it's the entrepreneurship that goes on all the time, the innovation that goes on, not just to provide the safety, the refuge, the alternative, but to provide the right, as you say, so to recognize the cultural importance of it. And giving the circumcisers grain machines, grinders, to use instead of cutting young girls. Brilliant. Yes.
Sorry. My question is about contraception, both for the women who are at high risk of being raped in communities and for...
Mike, please.
My question is about contraception in two contexts. One is for women who are at risk of being raped in the Congo, in the war zones. And secondly, for the girls and women who you care for and send off onto a new path in life. Is contraception or access to the ability to plan your family part of what you imagine in this picture and in this larger vision? And do you have access to contraceptives?
I was talking to somebody yesterday, and he was asking me, what exactly do you do? I said, well, I come from a community that has so many problems, and I cannot be going to the field every day talking about FGM. Today I go to the field, I talk about family planning. You need to plan your family. Why do I need to plan my family? Because these days, our women give birth to a very big number of children than before. Our father's family, you are about 5, 6. But these days you find somebody younger than me having 15 kids. And this is what is happening. Because they are not aware. Not because they think that is what they are supposed to be doing. Giving birth. Because they don't take their kids to school. and they don't care about how they dress or what they eat. So coming from, that is the problem of coming from a community that has so many problems. This time you're talking about water. Can you drill water for us? Then one will get confused. What is wrong with this woman? She educates on FGM and now she's talking about water. And then I come to you, I say, can you construct a classroom for us? Because our people need a classroom. That is the problem. Because our community has a lot of problems. And we must empower a woman. You must see that a woman has clean water. A woman has access to health. And then if you don't again talk about education, then you'll not be doing anything. So we try to talk about all that. And we also talk about HIV/AIDS because we don't leave it behind. Because if we don't talk about it, it will sweep the small community. So we are a multipurpose when we are in the field. And that is the only that's the only way this community will accept us and respect us and even get the information we give them.
I think it's obviously very clear to everyone in this room what an asset Agnes is to her community and what a great example. What a great example she is, too, of the person within the community, in this case, a very early empowered woman who knew the answers to the questions when someone said, what do you need? It's not a one answer, and it's not an answer that ends with the first solution offered. It continues to go on, and that has been the beauty and the effectiveness of this collaboration, and we look forward to many more years of it. If you saw Agnes and Eve kiss in the slide that went by earlier, we consider that an annual event, and we have to have the blessing from Agnes that we're providing what she needs. The activists who come into V-Day come from many areas, many places, and in many ways. Corinne came into V-Day by going on the website while she was already actively involved in the Planned Parenthood movement in Europe, saw that V-Day was offering a stop rape contest, looking for innovative ideas to actually stop rape in communities, entered the contest, and pick up the story there, Corinne.
Yeah. I think I kind of possibly got involved with V-Day without even knowing it when I saw the Vagina Monologues for the first time. Because when I saw the play, the same thing that happened to many other people around the world happened to me. I was, you know, it kind of something went click and my body reconnected with my mind and things made sense all of a sudden and I, you know. So, and I was working in this kind of more traditional NGO field. I'd been active in the kind of women's movement for a while. I'm German. I was brought up in Western Germany. Then I lived in Western Europe. I got a good education, etc. Studied political sciences, all that. But what was missing for me in a way was this kind of this ability to be creative and to be a bit more, you know, react to your heart and to your stomach rather than just the kind of the theoretical or the intellectual approach to it. And so when I saw that V-Day had this stop rape contest and I asked activists around the world to send in ideas as outrageous as we wanted them to be, and we needed to send in just maximum 2 pages, which is unheard of. Like anyone who's writing project proposals for donors knows that this is not the usual way of doing things. So a friend of mine and I, we saw this and we thought, wow, this is fantastic. We want to be part of it. And so we started thinking about it. And we went back to, at the time I lived in Belgium, in Brussels, and we went back to, we both happened to be two German women who both came from small family businesses in Germany, from bakeries. And we drew on our roots in that way, to think about like how can we reach out to people in Germany, a community that we know because we've grown up there. How can we reach out to make a difference and to firstly raise awareness on the extent of sexual violence and the realities of it. For instance, that mainly it's perpetrators who are known to the victims, that a very small percentage of women actually go to the police, etc. But also, more importantly, possibly, how can we get the information on the help services out to the women who might need them? And so because we grew up in bakeries, we knew that in Germany, there's like you have them in every village, but you also have them in big cities. So you can reach out anywhere, because many of those awareness-raising campaigns, they go to the capitals, and that's kind of it. But with this campaign, you can reach anyone. So it's, in a way, Agnes walks from village to village, which is much more labor-intensive than that. But in a way, this is also something that can really, that can go everywhere. And so this was basically the idea, to use bakeries and the bread and the rolls that people buy every morning. They're sold in paper bags, which obviously give a lot of surface to print information on, and usually it's the advertising with the logo of the company, etc. But so we suggested to use it to print messages on it. And we also, we had this slogan, which is a German wordplay, which people picked up on nationwide afterwards, which is rape doesn't go in the bag. In German, if you say something doesn't go in the bag, it means it's completely out of question, totally unacceptable. And so having a bag and saying that rape, you know, so that was the slogan of the campaign. And then we printed kind of statistical information to educate people about the extent of it. And we and on the back of the bag, there would be the information of the local rape crisis line, of the women's shelter, so that women who need this information have it easily accessible, and also in a way that is not that doesn't raise suspicion, if you want, from an abusive partner, for instance. If you have this information sitting on your kitchen table, you have the phone number in front of you. You can call it when you need. And so, there was the Stop Rape contest back in 2001, and we won the contest. So V-Day funded the implementation of the kind of a pilot of this campaign. So we got, I think it was around $10,000 at the time, and so we could actually go and print the bags, pay for the printing of the bags and for the distribution to different bakeries. So the next step was to go and find bakeries, because everyone I talked to about this was like, how the hell are you going to, you know? because I grew up in a bakery and I knew both my father and my mother, I knew how those family businesses run. The man is in the back baking and the woman is in the front. And most of the sales staff are women also. So, and I kind of trusted in that, and I just went ahead. And this is again something which I think is typical for V-Day, you know, trusting and not thinking about what can't happen, but thinking about what is possible. And so I trusted that, and I reached out also with the help of my family to some people in a town that I identified, a town of 200,000 citizens. And so I reached out to one woman, like one shop owner, co-shop owner with her husband, and I spoke to her, and she liked the idea. She was very open to it, and she was someone who was in the professional community. She was someone very well respected, and so she picked up the phone on that day, and she called two of her colleagues, and she said, I'm going to send someone over to you. She has this brilliant idea, and, you know, we are going to participate in our shop, and, you know, I recommend that you do that too. So I went with my little, my mock-up paper bag. I went to them, and I showed them what I was planning, and they agreed to do it. And I partnered with the local family planning organization, with the local rape crisis center, whose phone numbers were on the bags. And also we had a very enlightened women's officer of the government of the city, who was very committed and who was an activist herself. And so she was also on board, and she got us the press conference of the official city mayor's press conference to launch the project. And so everything came together beautifully.
And how many now have been distributed?
Yeah, so this was the first campaign back in 2001. And since then, we did a little research for the 10th anniversary of V-Day. And this was in 2008. So between 2001 and 2008, we did an online search. We identified that more than the campaign has been repeated more than 60 times across the country and neighboring German-speaking countries. So, for instance, the capital of Germany, Berlin, they do it every year for the 25th of November for the International Anti-Violence Day. And it's something that has really spread. And all the other campaigns have been kind of self-financed. So the local organizers managed to find their own ways, either by getting the bakeries to pay for the bags or by getting corporate sponsors or raising money some other way. So it's just been kind of,
self-organized, self-funded. Yeah.
So
and how many was it that you found in...
Well, it was by 2008. I haven't counted 2009 and 2010 yet. By 2008, it was over 60 campaigns, and it was over 10
million
bags.
Again, a very simple idea, but it's done enormous amounts of good in the raising awareness. And now Corinne has come on board as a V-Day staffer. She moved from an activist to the European director because we needed one, as it turned out, because there were just so many requests from Europe. This last year, the European women members of the European Parliament performed the vagina monologues. And every time this happens at that level, as well as a slum in Kaburo, it reminds us that it was only 12 years ago when I first did the story on Eve Ensler and the vagina monologues for CNN, and I could not say the word vagina. Imagine doing an entire story on a play and a book called The Vagina Monologues and unable to say the word vagina. The movement has made this connection again, which Corinne said, and I just want to mention it again, the connection between mind and body. And that's been really the nature of Eve's work and the whole impetus behind using the books and the plays and this conversation for what it stimulates and opens. Now, let's continue the conversation because there were so many hands up before, and I'm standing so that I might be sure and see all sides. And we'll start here with a very patient person who waited through the last session. And I just want to recognize and honor the amount of work that I know is represented in this room. On every row, I see somebody who's doing extraordinary activist work on the ground in their communities, educating, empowering, economic. The levels of partnerships that are represented in this room makes me wish we could just all have a big session and say, okay, you do this, I do that, we'll find all those assets we need and change the world. Meanwhile, let's continue the conversation.
My name is Ndidi Muneli, and I'm a social entrepreneur based in Nigeria. And I'm glad that I actually got to ask the question after Corinne or make the comment, because I have been working in cities, and I've lived in many parts of the world. And over the last 3 months, what has struck me is the number of educated women who are being abused in their marriages and the number of women who I know who have 2 or 3 degrees who are in the United States, in Europe, in Africa, who are facing the same challenges and they can't speak up. And that has scared me because I just don't know what's happening in our generation, my generation, the 30s generation, and they've been to the best schools in the world. So I really feel like there's an urgent need for us. It's very important to address the Maasai Mara and women in rural communities, but the women who are supposed to be the empowered ones working with... And I mean, one particular example is someone who's a motivational speaker and a coach. And when she told me about what was going on in her life, I said, you can't help yourself. And so there's a big challenge that we're facing. And I want to tie that to recently in Nigeria, we had the Tarzan monologues. A guy wrote, inspired by the V monologues, a Tarzan monologue. And then he and the V monologue people actually had a face-off, Tarzan versus V monologues. And I was actually happy that they had the Tarzan monologues, because for the first time, men were talking about their pain, their hurt, which comes to your comments, and so that they got to talk with women, because we have a lot of damaged men who are doing damaging women, and they need help too. So, I mean, I'm raising these issues, and I would love to hear how the V monologues and other organizations can start working with these groups. I'm not in this space, but it's something that has touched me, and I hope that it's touching others. Thanks.
Right, thank you. Corinne spoke earlier of the fact that this year there's a huge emphasis within V-Day to bring V-Day men to a different place. The men have always been involved in the V-Day movement. My husband's sitting over there with a vagina warrior button on, which many men have been wearing who've been a part of raising money for V-Day and its activities for a long time. But it's moved to a different level, interestingly enough, in the last 2 years. And I'd also like to respond to your question about the level of abuse and among a certain number of empowered and educated women. We've seen an enormous increase in the number of reports and requests that come to our websites and to the activities of exactly that group. So we clearly need to be making it possible for them to speak out about their pain and for men to come to the table and speak out about theirs and find ways that this dialogue can lead to action. And as again, there are people in this room who could speak very specifically to other therapies and innovative strategies, so please feel free to speak up. Yes.
My question is, Catherine. Where are the institutions? Where are the churches? Where are the moral...
We'll
ask you to start again.
Where are the churches? Where are the institutions of business? We're all talking about a grassroots organization, but violence against women is so fundamental. And we have supposedly moral structures in our society that are supposed to be addressing fundamental rights of all people. Where are they in this?
Well, if I may talk about the churches, when we started female genital mutilation, the churches are against female genital mutilation. But they cannot speak it loud for fear of losing people in their churches. So when we came in as an organization, they were happy, and these days we collaborate with them. When they have their church sessions, they invite us. We go and talk about FGM. So all the other groups are there. We don't want to say we are working alone, but when we are in the field, we collaborate, just as I said, we collaborate with Equality Now, who are doing their part of the law. They hire a lawyer. We just can't achieve all what we achieve by ourselves. We collaborate with other groups that are on the ground.
Karen, you wish to say anything?
Yeah, well, you know, V-Day, the model how V-Day works has very much to do with who the local organizers reach out to. And there have been, I mean, there's thousands of events that took place, and there are events also that took place in the context of religious communities. I remember, for instance, there was some years ago, there was a V-Day in a synagogue in London, just to give an example. So, you know, wherever this collaboration is possible and wherever people are open for dialogue, I mean, we also had experiences where, you know, certain branches of Christianity were not so open about talking about vaginas. You know, it's like wherever the dialogue is possible, our activists engage with those groups. And V-Day is also a very interesting way to engage, you know, many kind of private sector sponsors who would usually maybe not necessarily think firstly of donating money for a women's charity that is working to end violence against women, such as a rape crisis or, you know, a service provider like that. But through getting involved in this theatrical performance or, you know, like an artistic production, they are possibly more open to get involved. So V-Day has brought an enormous number of kind of new players and new actors and new donors on board for the fight to end violence against women. V-Day has worldwide mobilized over $70 million. This is a lot more than, for instance, you know, if you look at the United Nations Trust Fund on Violence Against Women, I don't know the exact figure, but I remember a few years ago we did a comparison, and it was, you know, it was much, much less. So it's really the amount of and the amount of good. I mean, you know, it's not the figure itself is not important, but what is important is that the amount of good that can be done with that money, the number of shelters that can be kept open, the number of shelters that can be built where there was none before, you know, the rape crisis helpline that can be kept open for women who need help.
It's such a good question, Catherine. I think it's worth noting that recently the assets were looked at in terms of philanthropic dollars in the U.S. alone, and less than 17% of the philanthropic dollars go to violence-related activities. and to support groups involved in the work against violence. So it does not, it still does not surface as the what Eve likes to call violence is the mother of all other issues. Because if you can't make a woman safe and secure, she cannot be educated as a young girl, and she certainly cannot be empowered or free to pursue her fullest potential, whatever that might be. But it's not been, that recognition has not happened at the level that it needs to happen, or nor has it been followed by philanthropic dollars at this point on the grand scale. Bunker. Please identify yourself and take the mic.
Bunker Roy from the Barefoot College. I wanted to hear Agnes before I offered to collaborate. Inspiring, thank you. What we do, Agnes, in Africa, almost covered the whole continent of Africa, is to take illiterate rural grandmothers from very remote villages. We've covered about 22 countries in Africa, including Kenya. And courtesy Indian government, we get the grandmother's ticket paid by the government of India, and we take them to the Barefoot College. And through only sight and sound and hands, and not the written word or the spoken word, we train them to be solar engineers. And they go back and solar electrify their own villages. We have found that in Africa, men are untrainable. They are ambitious. They are compulsively mobile. And they all want a certificate. And the moment you give them a certificate after any training, they leave the village and go into a city. So if you go to villages in Africa, as you know, you'll only have very old people and very young people. They are very old and very young. So investing in grandmothers is the best thing that we've done. Now, may I offer to take some grandmothers from your villages, wherever they are?
Okay.
And we would like to train them to be solar engineers. And we will ask Vide to collaborate. Because the government of India looks after the software, but the hardware we need to get some support.
You've just got an agreement. Catalyzing collaboration. That's what we're all about. That's a wonderful place to end, but there's been a very patient person in the back. Raised your hand throughout, so I don't want to leave it up.
Thank you. Thank you. I just also wanted to applaud Agnes for the wonderful work, Agnes, that you're doing in Masai Mara. And I hope to work with you. My name is Minu Fulusang. I run a civic media platform in Tanzania. We basically educate rural populations around issues of HIV, health issues, but also Bunker Roy on solar energy, many issues. But I wanted to just mention that 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was down in Masai Mara, called in by a group that operate a tourist company down there, namely a sustainable, responsible tourism company. And what's interesting, I think, also talking about tourism, there was somebody who asked a question about it earlier, what can we do? Because there are a lot of tourists and people traveling to Africa to meet the Maasai and the authentic cultures and the wildlife. And you see a movement now also in tourism to operate sustainable, responsible tourism companies, meaning also involving local communities in the operations of those tourist activities. And one of the things that Basecamp Explorer, for instance, are doing down in Talek in the Masai Mara is involving the local Maasai as much as possible, creating outreach programs to educate women and men in issues around health, right. HIV prevention, but also encouraging tourists to contribute philanthropically mm-hmm. to, for instance, putting young girls through education. And the program has about nearly, I think, 100 young girls now being supported to education. But it's also setting up a handicraft project for women so that they can generate income and have an income to bring back to their families and educate their daughters, producing jewelry, basically, for the tourist industry. So I also wanted to just mention this, that, you know, tourism, responsible tourism, is a field which is growing, and there are also things that can be done to contribute through that mechanism.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Our time is up, and we are asked. I do want to say just finally, on behalf of Eve, how much we appreciate this opportunity to put forth V-Day simply as one of the many models that are here at the Skoll Forum, and hope that in some way the work that we have done for the last 12 years with the help of these enormously important activists who are powerful forces in their own right and who V-Day feels privileged to work with, Agnes and Corinne, and to honor the contributions that each of you bring to this as well. Eve always ends every V-Day conversation of any kind by asking people who have either been experienced violence in their own lives or know someone who has been a victim of violence to stand, and in doing so, honoring the victims of violence all over the world. So if you would do that, please, and thank you very much for your attention today.